So first notice we're still alive. And why that sounds silly is because, you know, deep in our bones we have this misconception that we're permanent. One of the many lies that Buddha says are embedded in our being from habit. So we have to argue with it. So from this comes a sense of urgency. Mustn't waste this precious life. So for this reason, here today, we're sitting here together, listening, including me, to these views of the Buddha about reality, about happiness, about suffering, about the mind, about how things are, so that we can hear the advice in it and use it to help us develop the two wings of the bird, the wisdom wing, compassion wing, our own amazing potential, which then qualifies us to see others and help them all the way to Buddhahood. So that kind of longish motivation is expressed in the second two lines of this prayer. And the first two lines, remember, just reiterating our reliance on the Buddha and his teachings for those of us who already identify with being Buddhists. And if you wanted to sing the prayer with me, it's on page whatever.
Sangye charang choke chok namla jangcho badu dagni kyab suchi dagi chanyen gipe sonam ki drola penche sangye drupa shok sangye charang choke chok namla jangcho badu dagni kyab suchi dagi chanyen gipe sonam ki drola penche sangye drupa shok sangye charang choke chok namla Changchu badu dagni kyab suchi, dagi chanyen gipe sonam ki, drola penche sangye drupa shok.
So this analogy, a bird needs two wings, sounds very lovely, but it's kind of got a real, it's kind of a valid, very valid, and it's a perfect way of framing all the teachings. You know, as I mentioned yesterday, and we've been talking all week, this packaging, this construct of all of Buddha's teachings from the Tibetans, you know, taking all the main points of this vast body of knowledge and philosophy and metaphysics and meditation and psychology of Buddhism and putting in a nice orderly structure. Like any other body of knowledge which we want to internalize, it's presented orderly. Orderly in terms of your capacity to internalize it. Music, maths, anything, you look. But for some reason we think spiritual teachings are kind of mystical and different, but actually they're not. It's, you know, incremental, gradual. So as we've been discussing again and again, the wisdom wing is the nuts and bolts of Buddha's view, really, his vast world view of what the mind is, how it functions, how it's driven by this natural law of karma. Remember, Buddha's not a creator, and he hasn't made this up. He's not speculating. It's not revelation from on high. It's coming from his own observation. And he's saying every one of us can observe the same by developing out this marvelous potential we've got, you know. So in a sense, the wisdom wing is like the retreat mode. It's like minding your own business. Back off. Leave sentient beings alone. Don't harm them. Don't jump on the wrong people. Don't kill them. Don't take from them. First level, discipline, ethics. Live in, you know, the powerful morality of vows. According to Buddha, vows are so potent, you know, give so much power to our mind, to our practice, and so really program us in a marvelous way, you know, psychologically. So the culmination of the wisdom wing, if we were on the Theravadan path, if we were on the Hinayana path, you know, we would finish, at, like we've been talking a lot and using the analogy that I'm using because we understand it, the first level of practice, you know, let's call it junior school. The next one is high school. Well, that's the wisdom wing. First level, control your body and speech. Next level, now get to becoming an actual Buddhist, work on your mind. Because now you're ready, because you've disciplined the servants of your mind, body and speech, behavior. So all of this is, this is the wisdom wing. This is like the retreat mode. You're being cautious. You're protecting yourself. You're all benefit, your own benefit. Never doubt this. Sometimes we get a little bit holy and think, oh, how can it be for my benefit? That's selfish. Rubbish. Got to become this marvelous person yourself, understand suffering and its causes yourself, then you can help others. So we finish the, if we kind of graduated at high school, having controlled our body and speech, living in vows, you know, doing the retreat mode, unpacking and unravelling the contents, getting to see our own reality, becoming who we really are, we'd have to realise emptiness, quote unquote. So like we've been talking, though, if we're looking at the Mahayana structure, the Bodhisattva path structure, you know, that's kind of, that's taught mainly in the later stages of the Bodhisattva path as the last two of the six perfections of the Bodhisattva. But in its nature, it's a Theravadan teaching. In its nature, it's a Hinayana teaching because you have to achieve your own nirvana. You don't have to go to the Bodhisattva path to get out of samsara. You've got to realize emptiness, cut the root, get to see truth, reality, how it is. So let's just look at this one again. So what we discussed so far, you know, looking at this structure, we got into high school at this level of getting some single-pointed focus, starting to unpack and unravel your mind, using Buddha's model of the mind as our basis for observing what is there, distinguishing, crucially, using the Buddha's model of the mind, as we've been discussing so much, distinguishing between the neurotic, ridiculous, fear-based, eye-based, disturbing, distorted, you know, embellishments, the misconceptions, the disturbing emotions that the Buddha has found from his own experience that are not at the core of our being. This is kind of profound. If we follow that all the way, we'd then get to the root, ego grasping, this fundamental marigpa, this ignorance that believes in this fantasy made up, independent me that doesn't exist. So let's just discuss this again. Let's look at it in the framework of the Heart Sutra. So if you've got the Heart Sutra, have we? Let's recite the Heart Sutra. You can do it in Italian and I'll do it in English. And you can do it in Japanese. And who else is there here? Nobody. Any other languages? And when Dalai Lama gets, he gets different, have you ever done that? You've been in his groups where he gets a different Buddhist to recite the Heart Sutra in their own language? You've not been that? You haven't done that? The Dalai Lama, have you been in his groups? We have, okay. You got it? So we'll just go through and try to look at the simple way, looking at the meaning of the words. I'm trying to be too mystical about it. What's it all about, you know? And I think when we Westerners say things in our language, we say them very boring, in a very sing-song, boring way. You know how Tibetans, they chant and kind of, it's like a bit like rap, you know? It's nothing rhythmic and energetic. It's very nice. We kind of very boring. So try and get kind of a bit like rap, a bit energy into it. Do you understand? Sort of chant it. See how it goes. Don't be embarrassed. You understand? You need it, Siliana. You lead it. You lead it, please. Okay? You be the omze. And you don't have to be too slow. I mean, one thing is interesting. I remember Lama Yeshe telling us in the monasteries, he said we would sometimes chant it so slowly that it would take as long as walking from here to Lhasa. And that was the kind of a good 2 hours. I mean, because that's when you can meditate on it. But you can also say it quickly. It's okay, you know? Just sort of stick the imprints in the mind. So follow Siliana. I'll do my own thing here. That's the I heard at one time, the Lord is dwelling in Bhajabhya and Bhajabhya and Mata with a great host of monks and a great host of bodhisattvas. At that time, the Lord was composed in the concentration called profound illumination. At that time, also the noble Lord, ever key to the bodhisattva and master of the practice of profound perfection and wisdom, looked down. He beheld with five scanners and their own being there empty. Then, through the inspiration of the Buddha, Venerable Shariputta said to the noble Lord, ever key to the bodhisattva, how should any child of good family trained who wishes to engage in the practice of profound perfection and wisdom? And any child of daughter wishes to practice the profound perfection and wisdom, look upon it thus. He or she beholds with five scanners and their own being. They're empty. Form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. It's a different form. It's formed as a different emptiness. Likewise, feelings, recognition, volitions, and consciousness are empty. So Shariputra, all dharmas are emptiness without differentiating marks, not produced, just stopped, not defiled, and not immaculate, not deficient, and not complete. Therefore, in emptiness, there's no form, no feeling, no recognition, no volitions, no consciousness, no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no visible form, no soul, no smell, no taste, no tangible, no mental object, no item, and so forth, no mind, no mental consciousness element, no ignorance and no extinction of ignorance, and so forth, no aging and death, and no extinction of aging and death. Likewise, there's no suffering, origin, cessation, or path. There's no wisdom, knowledge, no attainment, no non-attainment. Because there's no attainment, bodhisattvas abide, relying on the perfection of wisdom, awakened to the highest perfect enlightenment. Therefore, one should know that the mantra of perfection of wisdom is the highest mantra. The unequal mantra, the mantra that lays all suffering, the truth, and says nothing wrong, the mantra of the perfection of wisdom is proclaimed. Tata gate gate para gate parasam gate bodhisoha. In this way, Shai Buddha, bodhisattva and myself are trained in the profound perfection of wisdom. And the Lord rose from their concentration and commended the noble Lord over the key to the bodhisattva and myself, saying, also, for Sana Sanagatami, so it is the Sanagatami, so it is, just as you have taught, through the profound perfection of practice, the Tathagatas will rejoice. Thus spoke the Lord. And over the key to the bodhisattva and myself, the whole world that is seven as David, humans, and Jerusalem, and Jerusalem, were delighted and applauded the Lord's speech. Well done. So it's interesting about, you know, when we think of saying words, we think, oh, it's just words, so boring, you know. But because they mean things, it can't help but give kind of resonate, you know. Like I said yesterday, we finally got to meditate, go beyond concepts, guaranteed. But, you know, this is a good stepping stone, just hearing it. And, of course, the Buddhist approach of the mind, like I said, you know, as Lama Zopa puts it, it's like every millisecond of the day we're taking photos. Everything gets stored in our memory. That's how we can recall anything, because the memory of it's there. The imprint is there. So we just put the imprint in here, you know. Very, it's delicious. Otherwise, there's levels of practice. So let's just go through it. I mean, not that I know much, but I'll do my best. And just sit, look at the words and just kind of get a sense of even intellectually what's going on here. What's this long list of things, you know? Well, first of all, it's very nice that apparently Buddha taught in different ways. Now, sometimes he would just teach straight from his own mouth, like normal, you know. But other times it was a bit spacey, like this one. He's sitting there, he's in meditation. He's sitting in meditation, deep absorption. But what he's doing is channeling his thoughts to the minds of his highly realized disciples, Shariputra, and then it says Avalokitesvara. It's not the deity, it's not the Buddha, but it's in a human form. 10th level bodhisattva. And they're having this conversation, but basically they're being channeled from Buddha's mind and they're Buddha's words. It's kind of curious. This is one of those teachings. So this teaching was given in Rajgir. I don't know if you've been there, the Vulture Peak. It's really tiny. You walk up many, many stairs and there is a little spot with the four walls and it's up high, very beautiful, but it's quite small, you know. So I always used to wonder, when you read here, it says, he was dwelling on the mass of Vultures Mountain together with a great community of monks and a great community of bodhisattvas. And I'd always wonder, well, where do they sit? And I asked Geshe Tekchok, our wonderful lama in San Francisco. He said, oh, what do you think? In the sky. Let's just think we're in the sky, okay, with the Buddha. So, yes, as it says here, I took these headings. I've got headings in mind. You haven't got those there. But, you know, the first one is this, call it a common prologue. Thus did I hear at one time. The Bhagavan was dwelling. It tells us what's happening, you know. The Buddha's there, he's teaching, and all these people are there. Special prologue, it says. At that time, the Bhagavan was absorbed in the concentration on the categories of phenomena called profound perception. That was what he was doing. That's specific. And now, then it's the next heading says, Buddha blesses the minds of Shariputra and Avalokitesvara. That's exactly what's happening. And they're the ones who do the talking. But it's Buddha's thoughts, you know. At that time, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva, Avalokitesvara, looked upon the very practices of the profound perfection of wisdom and beheld those five aggregates also as empty of inherent nature. Okay, so now, Shariputra asks the question. Then, through the power of Buddha, the Venerable Shariputra said this to the Bodhisattva Mahasattva, Avalokitesvara, how should any son of the lineage train who wishes to practice the activity of the divine perfection of wisdom. But before we go on, wisdom in general, as we know, like wisdom wing, the essence of it finally is the ultimate wisdom of realizing the non, the absence of the fantasy I. But all the other teachings, as we've been discussing, as we start to look into the ridiculous attachment and aversion, all these branches of the ego grasping, the root delusion, the root misconception, they're also misconceptions, they're also ignorance. But this is the deepest ignorance, which is counteracted by this deepest wisdom, if you like. So that, as I said, if you need to achieve your own nirvana, as you would if you were training in Burma or Thailand, you wouldn't hear the Bodhisattva teachings there. But you need to realize emptiness. So emptiness itself is a Theravadin teaching, a Hinayana teaching. You need it to realize emptiness. You need it to get out of samsara. But, as I said, it's taught in the Mahayana path in the framework of the most advanced stages of the Bodhisattva path, the six perfections. Once you've achieved bodhicitta, you then go to this next stage and you bop along from life after life after life, perfecting your, until you eventually, you know, this is the gradual path. You become this Buddha. But meanwhile, you're benefiting countless sentient beings on the way, you know. So here it's taught as the last two of the six perfections. So whenever you hear the perfection of wisdom, you know it's emptiness from the Bodhisattva perspective in the framework of bodhicitta. Emptiness on its own is not a Mahayana teaching, but when it's taught in the framework of the Mahayana path, it's always in conjunction with bodhicitta. So that's what the perfection of wisdom. Because emptiness is emptiness is emptiness. The emptiness that a Hinayana arhat realizes is the same emptiness as the Bodhisattva. What makes the difference in the power and marvelousness of the Bodhisattva is their bodhicitta and their countless eons of unbelievable, powerful work on behalf of sentient beings. So that they're super powerful, super amazing. That's what gives more power. So the question. So then the answer. He gives an answer. He says that the Bodhisattva, Mahasattva, then he says, Shariputra, any son of lineage or daughter of the lineage who wishes to practice the activity of the profound perfection of wisdom should look upon it like this, correctly and repeatedly beholding those five aggregates also as empty. So that sounds a bit weird. What do you mean the five aggregates? Well, this gets us to the point here, because he now starts to list, basically, all he's doing here is listing the components of the universe according to Buddhist philosophy. Isn't it? I mean, this is not how we think in the world. We don't talk about the five aggregates. We don't talk about the four elements. We've got different components according to the model, the materialist model, isn't it? Well, this is the Buddha's. And this is coming back from these Indians well before the Buddha, these genius philosophers and thinkers and scholars, the ones who invented this incredible technique called single point of concentration. This is their model of the universe. So this is a list of the components. So the first lot is called the five aggregates. I mean, we could spend the next 6 weeks if we wanted to discussing this, but let's look at it simply. One of the sutras the Buddha taught is he presented these five aggregates. An aggregate just means a bunch of things together, a little heap of things, you know. Sometimes they call it the five heaps. So basically he gave this description of what makes up, there are two ways of looking at it, what makes up the entire impermanent universe itself. And you can divide them into these five, or more simply, and this is one we can understand, in what makes up a person. So, in terms of phenomena in this universe, we are an example of a type of phenomenon called a person. You know, a person. We're a person. So, and a dog is a person. An ant is a person. A Buddha is a person. A hell being is a person. They're all persons, beings, sentient beings. Well, Buddha's not called a sentient being. He's just called a Buddha. Regular guys like you and me are called sentient beings. So anyway, the five aggregates is a good way to describe the components of a person. So what he's saying is the five aggregates. One is, okay, so what he's doing, as we know in this list, he's giving this list and he's telling us that there is not any of these things. So of course, if we read this, we're going to drown in misery and nihilism. Oh, well, there's none of these things. Why bother? But of course, we've got to be more nuanced in our understanding and know that what he's saying is there is no inherent form, there is no intrinsic feeling, there's no intrinsic discrimination. So basically, the list. Let's look at the list then. So these five aggregates. One way of dividing this very simply is into two, as we've been discussing when we looked at discussed before. We've got matter, which is the elements, and this is the model they use, the four elements. We don't talk like that. We can see that now. But this is still the model they use. And certainly in the Vajrayana system, you know, this very sophisticated presentation of the physical universe and the body and the way, and especially when we went through the death process, remember? The elements play a major role. So it seems, you know, just because the materialist philosophical, the philosophical materialist, which is the view that prevails in our culture, doesn't talk about the four elements, it doesn't mean that that new view contradicts the previous one. It just seems to me there's different ways of presenting, isn't it? I mean, you know, they're just different ways of presenting, like different languages. So here, so we're made up of body, and we're made up of mind, consciousness. This non-physical capacity for cognition, which is the component that distinguishes us from this matter right here, a microphone. That's the four elements as well. So is this. But this is imbued with a consciousness. That's the defining characteristic of a person, a consciousness. A mind possessor, that's a lovely term in Tibetan, for Semchen, sentient being. So the first one is form. That's referring to the physical. So when you get the long commentaries on this, you're going to get a detailed description of the four elements and how they function and how they interact with each other, because that's the components of the physical matter. That's the first one. Pretty straightforward. Then you've got, in that list, the five. Going on a bit, the last one, you've got consciousness. Well, that's you can summarize it in a sense into that. Body and mind, physical and mental. But he adds a bit more, for good reason. Well, the third one, no compositional factors. What that is really is a grab bag of all the leftover bits and pieces that aren't covered in the other four. And now, not to get too technical, but there are other things that exist within a person. So one of those would be called karmic imprints, and or even karma, this law of karma. That technically is not either mind or form. It's usually, when you study philosophy, you learn there are three categories. There are three kind of phenomena. Two kind of phenomena. Impermanent phenomena and then so-called permanent phenomena, which gets us very confused. But it's really just referring to abstract phenomena. So there are some things within us that are also that. So we don't want to go into detail here. It doesn't matter. But they're not impermanent. And they're not body and they're not mind. So that's like a third category of stuff in this grab bag of leftover bits and pieces, as well as all the other. So the other point is, consciousness in general here is referring to the mind stream, to our capacity for cognition, mind in general. But then, as we know, if we study the mind, we discuss a lot, actually, we look into the components of our mental consciousness, and that's where you look at this Buddhist presentation of the mind, which actually, came from the Hindus. They're the ones who, through their own meditation, observed the mind, mapped the mind. It's pretty amazing. So then we've looked into the three categories of all the different states of mind. We've got the negative, neurotic, ego-based, ones that source the source of our pain and suffering that are not at the core of our being, and those that are valid, virtuous, reasonable, appropriate, valid cognitions, love, compassion, kindness. And then the third category, I like to call the mechanics, the stuff that makes us function, like concentration, good memory. Whether you're a murderer or a meditator, you need those. So there's this very particular way the Buddha describes these different components, as we've been discussing. So there are many of these. I mean, Buddha, as I said, apparently he ended up identifying 84,000 distinct mental problems. Luckily for our sake, he narrows it down to these three, the three poisons, the three toxic emotions. But there's a lot, if you're studying the master's program here, you're going to be studying the text called Lohrig, Mind and Awareness, which is, again, coming way back. And it's just a list of 51 different states of mind. There are thousands, but these 51 are kind of very specific, particularly in relation to helping us develop concentration, and so we can meditate. So this 51 is a typical kind of packaging. Well, here, the Buddha presents two of those, no feeling and no discrimination. So why did he pluck out of the 51 two to give them special status? Because of their powerful role in perpetuating attachment and therefore samsara. So like we talked, you know, feeling, if you look at this category of states of mind, three categories, so-called, keep it simple, without being moralistic, just negative, positive, neutral, the ridiculous, neurotic, deluded, miserable, unhappy ones that make us miserable and cause us to harm others, attachment, anger, jealousy, you name them, we all know them. There are misconceptions, invalid cognitions. And don't get judgmental, don't get nervous, Buddha's not trying to criticize us. It's like distinguishing between a weed and a flower, you know, you've got to know the difference. It's not kind of judgmental. You won't upset botanists if you call a weed a problem. They've got particular characteristics. And then you've got the so-called mechanics. Well, there's one called feeling. We discussed this, and it's very powerfully important to understand if you want to understand Buddhism. So, this feeling, actually, curiously, it's when we think of feeling, we mean emotion, Emotion. Not like that. It's bare bones sensation, if you like. Bare bones, just bare bones, the capacity to feel. And it's either through the senses or the mental consciousness. And that's in the third category, feeling. And that's there every millisecond. There's a category of five of these 51 that are called the always present states of mind. And without any one of these, you'd be an insane person. They're all working away non-stop. Of course, we've never recognized them. And we're not discussing the brain here, remember? So one is called intention. That drives everything. If you want a boss in here, you don't need a self to run the show. That's an irrelevant rubbish. But if you want to find a boss, it's the part of our mind called intention. And that's there every millisecond. But it's so instinctive for us now that we don't even notice this intention, It's just, but every millisecond. And that drives everything and anything we think and do and say. And because we're programmed with attachment and anger and depression and jealousy, well, it drives us into that. So we've got to, that's why we've got to have the mind and be aware so we can unpack this stuff and start being in control of our mind in a valid, positive way, So intention is a bit, like I said, we said during the week, intention is the best word for karma. Intention is mental action. Karma means action. So every millisecond we have an intention, that's mental action. And then what it does is inform some of those actions to become actions of body and speech. They're the servants of our mind, remember? And this happens like a millisecond by millisecond. So, so fast, So, one is intention, one is attention, one is discrimination, or another word. I forget. It's the ability, it's every millisecond it's there, and it's the ability to be able to distinguish between anything, like right in this room now, as we just look around, we're distinguishing a million different things. Colour, red, this, Buddha, yellow, that, person, glasses, this, shirt. We're very distinct, very clear. That's discrimination. And if we didn't have that, we'd be mad. We'd be, falling into rivers and eating poison and we'd be dead in a second. It's super brilliant part of our mind. Intention, attention, discrimination. What's the fourth one? Feeling is one. Every millisecond, as long as we're existing, we have, and there's only three kinds. Pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. Well, let's forget the neutral. They are boring. There's a whole discussion there. We don't need to worry about that in our lives. We have pleasant and unpleasant. And they're another word for happiness and suffering. This is Buddha's analysis, Pleasant and unpleasant feelings. Now, we know we only want the pleasant ones. And we know we can't stand the unpleasant ones. So what do you think attachment's job is? So attachment is in the category called the first category. This maniac that runs the show. This vampire. This poor, hungry, emotional hunger, manipulator, controller that's running everything underneath. Desperately trying to find the objects out there, first level, such that when we have contact with them, pleasant feeling is triggered. That's what we mean by getting happiness, isn't it? And we spend our lives from the time we're born and the time we die to attempt to do that job. That's what Buddha means by being in samsara, driven by this insane, demented attachment that's completely leading us up garden paths, that lies to us. All these words are valid, It's so instinctive, so primordial, and its main job is to find something out there. This is the deepest, the grossest level of it, which means the objects of the senses, isn't it? Such that we have contact with it, and then boom, pleasant feeling comes. That's our method for getting happy. That's our method. That's it. We discuss this. And then all we're saying, remember, that Buddha's found these amazing methods to bypass the stupid looking things, to bypass attachment. To contact our own actual state of bliss that is already there. He's found methods that are cheap and cheap, not easy, but cheap. Getting happiness from sense objects is a lot of work and a lot of effort and very expensive. And he says it doesn't last anyway, so it's kind of you're disappointed. And he says he's got methods, to access, to become who we really are, bypassing attachment. Attachment is a misconception. So feeling is massively important. And that's the example I gave. Remember about the little boy fisherman? The little fisherman. If we take... Oops, excuse me. If we take this, you know, the view of Buddha's, the bigger picture, philosophical view of the, how our consciousness is beginningless and endless, you know, it's a nutty idea to us if we're materialists or if we're Christians. That's Buddha's analysis. And we come programmed into this life from the first second of conception with all our karmic imprints. It's just the way it is, Buddha says. No one made it this way. No one's running it. It's not punishment. It's not reward. It's a natural law. Although we find it hard to hear it that way because we put all this moralistic stuff onto it. So there's this fisherman. We can do. The story I told. This little boy came into this life. The mother, she was telling me the story about her boy, her fisherman son. And when she heard about karma, she was very distressed, you know. And he died at the age of 29 scuba diving. So basically he came into this life. You know, we can deduce from his behaviour, this is just the analysis, that he would have been in the lower realms in the past due to killing. That eventually exhausted that karma and like a miracle gets a human mummy again. And then as we discussed many times, the way karma ripens, there are four tracks of karma, four ways it plays out in our life. One is the type of birth we get. We've got the human one. So he got the human one due to past non-killing. Then the second track of karma is the tendencies within us, our mind. Capacity to be kind, loving, good, kill, lie, not kill, play music, play football, whatever. Our personality traits, our tendencies. They're programmed from our own past habits. They're a bunch of habits we come into this life with in this consciousness of ours. So he came into this life, a lovely boy, she said, kind, generous, all the good qualities. But he had a tendency to kill, and he discovered it when he went fishing. And this is the way Buddha describes in the 12 links as well, of dependent arising. So the imprint was there, the seed was there, the tendency to kill was there. He'd exhausted the main result of it, so got a human body again. But the tendency, and this is the one that's tragic, this is like a residual result of past actions, such that when you get born in this life, you have that tendency to continue to do it. Now, that includes all our good qualities. All our good qualities, you know. So I use the other example as a counterpoint. This boy, this little boy, three, his mummy, a friend of mine, Dai Chen, was taking the lice out of his head. I told the story. And he's crying with compassion for the lice. Neither mother had... This other little boy went fishing when he was five and fell in love with fishing. So neither mother had a chance to tell either one. Teach them killing or teach them to have compassion for lice. You can see that, you know. So the little boy with a tendency to fish, and this is how feeling works, and this is why it's so huge, this is why discrimination works, and this is why... And this is where attachment kicks in, and this is where feeling is so powerful, and why Buddha put it out, plucked it out and gave it this status of so important... in terms of looking at the components of a person. So what happened is he gets born, he's got a body, he's got a mind, which is a and then having the structure that we've got and the mind that he's got, there's this tendency to have pleasant feelings and unpleasant feelings. Because we have senses, which are very gross, they depend upon objects, that's clear. You know, hearing is a sense and it demands sound, and we all know... You know, and then each of the senses has its own object. And so in order to trigger something in our mind, because we're very gross in this bag of bones, we've got to get the object to trigger the feeling, don't we? Although we can be very good with our fantasies. We can have pretty strong fantasies and we can kind of replicate some very nice feelings or ugly feelings. I mean, you sit there thinking all day angry about your ex-husband, you're going to get pretty crazy. You don't need to see him to get angry. If you're having a fantasy about your boyfriend, the other kind, you don't need to even see him to get very nice feelings. We know that. Our mind's pretty powerful. But the objects play a huge role. So what feeling kicks in is this. There's this boy. We can deduce this. Past killing, now gets a human body as a result of non-killing. He'd exhausted the main karma of that particular lot. And then he's got all these tendencies. And he didn't know he had the wish to kill until he met fishing. He met the object, the event. And so because he had strong familiarity with that, it was like a memory of it. Of course, he didn't think he'd done it before, but that's how when we feel close to certain people or hate certain other people or really like certain activities, it's because we've got familiarity with it from having done it before. So any one of us, when we first heard the word Buddha, oh, that's interesting, and that's how come we're here. Many people hear the word Buddha and go, what's that boring word, and move on. No tendency. So he had tendency to kill. So the millisecond, this all happens in a millisecond. It's so brilliant. It's like technical. The millisecond, the fishing event was there. It triggered like a memory, really. And because he was familiar with it, and this is the point, the degree of his familiarity with that action is the degree to which he would have then experienced immediately a really pleasant feeling. And thus, the deeper the habit, the more powerful the pleasure. So it seems weird to us, doesn't it, that pleasure would come from killing, or pleasure would come from torturing. But this is the way samsara works. The familiarity. And it triggers feelings. This is what happens. So the millisecond he saw the event was there, pleasant feeling was triggered. Happiness. Then the killer, the next second, millisecond, trillionth of a second, attachment kicks in. And attachment's job is to paint a delicious picture of it to the extent that the good feeling is there. The more the good feeling, the more excited attachment is, and it makes this amazing story about how divine fishing is. This, we're so imbued with this. This happens so automatically, we never question. But because we're junkies for good feelings, that's why, you know, like I said, for us, we mightn't go around killing and raping and torturing too much. But look at our pathetic old habits, eating too much cake, you know, watching the television, reading your iPad. Little baby, baby, baby attachment habits. How we can't resist. How it's hard to stop because they trigger pleasant feelings. And we're junkies for pleasant feelings. Nothing wrong with pleasant feelings. It's good to have pleasant feelings. Buddha's saying the nature, as we talked, the nature of our mind, when it's unencumbered by all the junk, it is in its nature radiantly blissful. So pleasant feelings are perfect. But Buddha says our methods for getting it are ridiculous. And in fact, they end up causing us more unpleasant feelings, more suffering. That's the tragedy. So feeling is huge. Every millisecond, we are desperate for a pleasant feeling. We call it happiness, you know. And because we're so addicted to the external objects that trigger that pleasant feeling, we even mistake happiness for the external object. Like I said before, you know, tell me about your happiness, Rabina, and I'll just give great detail of my divine boyfriend, Ron. How kind, and what's in my mind is the vivid pictures of Ron. And I think that's happiness. No, it's my mind that's happy, my consciousness, my sensory. But we're so addicted to the external and so believing the external are the real cause of my happiness, we actually think that's the happiness. Now look what I'm angry and upset and despairing. Now I just said someone recently emailed me, husband of 20 years, she thought she had the best marriage in the whole universe. She probably did. Two kids, adored the kids, he was kind, he loved her, he rang her every day, they adored each other, and then suddenly everything's changed. And now he hates her, abuses her, left her, got new, you know, cheating on her. She's just, and we understand it, all she can think about is this. So she's got anger, which is here, but, you know, she's painting this vivid picture. So when she's describing her anger, she's describing this horrible husband. So she thinks that's unpleasant. That's what the suffering is. It's not. It's here. Suffering's here. That's just the object that triggers it, triggers the feeling. So feeling is massive. And because we desperately, attachment is a junkie for the good ones, then when it is killing and lying and stealing and torturing that causes it. Look at the poor pedophile. I mean, have compassion. Okay, lock him up, do something. But can you imagine being born with a tendency to want to jump on little girls all day? And you don't know why? Mummy didn't teach you. You have no idea why you want to kill fish all day. Or that example I gave of that American, you know, torturer from years ago, BTK, bind, torture, kill. A nice guy. Had a wife, children, went to church every day. A good member of the community, but he kept this secret life. Of course he'd keep a secret life. You can't torture in public. Get arrested. The fisherman, though, it's interesting. The fisherman, we don't mind about fishing in our culture. I mean, can you imagine if he's attached to killing poodles? He would have been in trouble. These are tendencies. These are tendencies, you know. This is Buddha's analysis. Okay, you've got to posit a possibility of consciousness here coming from before, which, of course, is not comfortable for us, but this is the Buddha's analysis. We come programmed, fully programmed already. Hitler's mother didn't create Hitler. That's mean to poor old Hitler's mum. It's a little Austrian housewife. What did she do? BTK's mum didn't invent her. The fisherman's mum didn't invent him. She came along to that mother who lived in this town with a river and he met fishing and it all played out, you know. But the feeling is the killer because we're frantic junkies for good feelings. That's all we want. And what do we do the rest of the time is try and avoid the things that will cause bad feelings. The mean ex-husband, the horrible food, this. Then we spend our, this is how we spend our lives. This is what Buddha means by being in samsara. And it's playing out a million times a second, and it's just completely programmed. So, of course, it's massively difficult to get beyond this, to go beyond this, you know. So all we can do is try, of course, practice every day. But it's good to have this technical analysis of it. It's very interesting. It's not just some kind of religion. And this is the observation of the great yogis. This is how it works, you know. And when we have great skill and concentration, we can see it too. That's why feeling and discrimination, because discrimination, this ability to check which object it is. I mean, if you have no discrimination, you'd be eating the fire, you know, and you'd die because you'd have no discrimination. There's many bits of our mind, these so-called neutral, the mechanics that play a role in enabling us to function. So feeling and discrimination, they're the major players in keeping us in samsara. That's why they get status, something like that, their own special status. Now I've lost it. What page was it? Can't remember. Okay. The first is form, which is referring to the elements, the physical. Second, feeling. Happiness, happy or unhappy, that's it. Discrimination. Then this grab bag of leftover bits, all in this compositional factors. And then finally, consciousness, which means the mind in general. They make this distinction, you know. That's the five aggregates, roughly speaking. So the next category of phenomena is called the six senses. Five regular ones, but in this context they refer to mental consciousness, which is all the thoughts and feelings and emotions as a sense. But technically we know the way the word is, we use it to refer to the five senses. So what is this referring to? Let's be specific here. It says no eye, ear, nose, but technically the eye and the ear and the nose are not senses. They're the physical matter. Okay, so if you look at the third category here where it says, I don't know, in the Italian, the third lot, it says no eye element and so on, including no mind element and no mental consciousness element, right? That's referring to a subtle physical energy that we don't posit in our scientific world. But they do say here is a subtle physical energy they don't refer to the eyeball. There's this subtle physical energy that then, when that's functioning, and then eye consciousness, which remember, consciousness is not physical. So technically you've got eye consciousness, which is that part of your mind that functions through the medium in our understanding of the eyeball and all the physical bits, as well as this subtler level called the eye element, which just means a subtle physical. When that's all together, then you can have then your eye consciousness is functioning. So consciousness, remember, is another word for mind, and it's not physical. So the eyeball is not consciousness. So the senses here, it's referring to the sense consciousness. No eye consciousness, no feeling, consciousness. The next lot are the objects of the consciousness. You can't have a cognition of colour without a thing that has colour. That's clearly absurd. Eye consciousness, to be a valid cognition, it needs a colour, because the colour is one of the objects of eye consciousness. The object of consciousness, the objects, which is, of course, here, each of the senses has their own, you know, I keep pressing the wrong button here. So you've got the five sensory consciousnesses, to spell it out. Then you have the objects of those five senses, and let's face it, that's the entire universe that we know. Sounds, smells, tastes, tactile objects, and shape and colour. That's it. The physical world. That's the objects of our senses, isn't it? And this is now, let's look into this a bit. We discussed this before. When you study the Buddhist model of the mind, you study that text called Lohrig. You study the epistemological model, which is, in fact, so amazing, so sophisticated, so brilliant. I'm quite sure materialist scientists would be blissed out to study it because it's so sophisticated. But you've got to posit the possibility they're not describing the brain. This is coming from the amazing work of these incredible Indians, and then the Buddhists after that, the Indians, who through single point of concentration developed this brilliant internal capacity to observe the workings of their own mind. It's pretty incredible, actually. So the epistemological model, like we discussed briefly, but it's really helpful here, it's powerful here, talking about the senses, is describing the way consciousness functions. So you've got the sensory consciousness, and you have the mental consciousness. So we, you know, We know we've got eye consciousness and we know we have love and compassion, but we sort of don't have such an analysis of them. The Buddha says it's very interesting. And as Lama Yeshe says, we make the body the boss, you know. We make, because why? Because we are embodied. This is physical body that for us looms so large in our lives. The feelings of our body. We determine our happiness and suffering most days based purely on what the body feels. Think about it. We're so utterly driven by our sensations, our sensory experiences. This looms hugely large for us. And that's why we spend most of our time trying to get the right sense object so we can get a bit of a nice, pleasant feeling, please. We can see it. It's our main job in life. And it's the senses. This is the grossest level of our consciousness. So then, of course, as I discussed, we give way more power to our sensory consciousness. So, for example, the fisherman, it's a really good example. The fisherman, because he had a tendency to kill in his little mind, that was then triggered upon seeing with his eyes that shape and colour out there. There's basically, he saw a bunch of shape and colour. This is the thing. The senses are very limited in their capacity for cognition. Okay, there are other ways of talking, I think, when you study the Prasangika view, how the senses can have more than just this. But keep it very simple here. The senses are profoundly limited in their capacity for cognition. So the objects of eye consciousness are only two. Shape and colour. That's it. So if there's the fisherman. He sees a little boy. He goes and he sees what's called fishing. The sea, the river, something, you know. But it's just shape and colour. Just shape and colour. But it quickly triggers, isn't it? In a millisecond, it triggers his mental consciousness, where all his memories are. Of course, from past life too. You don't know that. They all happen so quickly that we conflate what he sees with what's the story in his mind. So like I said about the cup, you know, oh, what a pretty cup, I'll say. We assume our eyeball is seeing a pretty cup. It's utterly ridiculous. It's like the fisherman. Within a millionth of a second, my mental consciousness, the Tibetan's point here, my mental consciousness is triggered. And that's where all the memories, all the stories, all the dramas, all the rubbish, all the love, all the compassion, all the wisdom, all everything is. And that's where the workshop is, as Lama Zopa says. And that is triggered instantaneously. So if eye consciousness can only cognize shape and color, if the little boy fisherman's consciousness can only cognize the shape and color out there, you know, what part of our mind cognizes a pretty cup? Well, it's clearly the mental consciousness. And what is that? A bunch of conceptual stories made up by our mind. A bunch of conceptual stories. So because his habit was to kill fish, that triggered that memory. Instantaneous, a million concepts in his little five-year-old mind popped up. He mightn't have articulated it like that. The memory was triggered, the karmic imprint. Then all these stories popped up instantaneously because of his attraction to it. And then attachment coming in, and this is the key one. That's the key one that makes up the story. Feeling is just bare bones. Because of habit, the pleasant feeling. And then attachment kicks in and writes this instant, brilliant novel. The story my mental consciousness says is, what a pretty cup. The story his mental consciousness quickly said was, oh, this is amazing. Why? Because he felt good. The stronger the good feeling, the bigger the lie attachment creates the fantasy about it. And then we are locked into these stories. It's kind of depressing. I mean, it's kind of interesting. When we understand it, we can start to deconstruct it. And as Lama Zopa says, stop believing in our karmic appearances. Start questioning. Not get sucked into the story, you know. Because it's like in a millionth of a second. So senses are very limited in their capacity. But because we have a lot of feelings with our senses, we have to work really hard. And we do to try to get some nice feelings, you know. But we give way more power to them than we think. They don't cognize beautiful things, ugly things. They don't cognize delicious and this and that. That's the mental story because of past habit. But it all happens in a second, so we don't see all the bits working, you know. It's very interesting. So, the five senses, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, tactile. Then there's mental consciousness. And then there are the objects of the five, of these five senses, the objects, which is, like I said, basically is the external universe, isn't it? It's very clear. Objects of the five senses. And then the subtle physical energy that it's dependent on for. Then the next category of phenomena is called the 12 links of dependent arising. There's one sutra that Buddha taught, one teaching Buddha gave, that describes roughly the series of steps we go through that ends up every second we're creating this entirety of a complete series of lifetimes. You know. So these 12 links. The first one is called ignorance. It's the root, the delusion that's there, the misconception. This is the root of all of them. This misconception about the nature of self. Primordially deep, the most primordial. And that's the first of the 12. Because of that, all the others come. If that were not there, samsara crumbles. There's nothing to build it on, you know. So because of that, because of this ego grasping, as I know colloquially, ignorance, maripa, this misconception about the nature of self and everything else, that's the main driver. The next every millisecond, then that's there. Then the next millisecond, every millisecond, intention, karma, followed through by action. And that, the second one. And that leaves an imprint in the consciousness, third link. And then the way it goes through, we're not going to go through them now, it goes through basically how that will then leave a seed in the mind, and then later on that'll ripen as the person in the womb. It'll give rise to birth, and then the person comes out, and then you perpetuate all these things, and then you die. It's described in terms of kind of sometimes two or three lifetimes. I won't go into it here. It's how we're continually creating every millisecond, every millisecond, every millisecond, countless series of rebirths, cycles of rebirth. Again, this is a Buddhist analysis from the great yogis' minds, those who've got the realization of this, how it's a technology of how we create karma, how we create causes, how we create lifetimes, you know. And therefore, giving the clue of how we can deconstruct that process and stop creating lifetimes. By, you know, of course, the main one is realize emptiness. That cuts the lot. That's like the atomic bomb on the lot. Best, you know. The 12 links of dependent arising. Then the next package is called the Four Noble Truths. You know, I'm not sure the truth. I don't think the truths are noble. I think it's the four truths for the noble ones, I think. And I'd rather have the word facts sometimes. I think truth sounds a bit holy, doesn't it? The four facts for the noble ones. So as we know very well, this is Buddha's first teaching, and it's his whole way of framing the universe in terms of suffering. And this is where the understanding of these feelings, pleasant and unpleasant, really can help us. So he describes the process. First he says there is suffering, and he describes three levels of it. We'll go into this in a second. We only really mentioned the first throughout. We mentioned the first two throughout the week. Second, there are causes. Third, you can get rid of it, suffering and its causes. And fourth, how to do it. I mean, it's a pretty practical presentation, you know. Of course, it's taught extensively and quite elaborately. But to keep it really simple, basically Buddha says there is suffering. And so what's suffering? Remember, what's suffering? Unpleasant feelings. But of course, he's meaning more than that here. He's talking about different levels. So one way of presenting is the three levels of suffering. And the first one is what we all know as suffering. Everybody agrees. It's when the bad things happen. In other words, when unpleasant feelings are triggered. Simply speaking, it's when it's when unpleasant feelings are triggered. This is really a way to put it. It sounds kind of a bit weird. Like, you know, you think that being tortured is when unpleasant feelings are triggered. It's true. I mean, the most intense unpleasant feelings are triggered if you're tortured, isn't it? That's the external event that triggers it. And the unpleasant feelings. So we all know there's a spectrum of those in this life. Okay, the bigger picture for Buddha, the bigger picture in all the realms of existence, this is referring to the lower realms. As we know, Buddha asserts, you know, the existence of trillions of sentient beings, trillions of mind possessors. And he says, we're all living in kind of different suburbs of reality. So in the desire realm, one of these packages of these, it's like six suburbs, and they're all different kinds of sentient beings experiencing different levels all the way on the spectrum between the most intense suffering to the most intense bliss. This is a defining characteristic of samsara, you know. So those in the god realms and the human, a couple of those, the three of those or something, they're the fruit of virtuous karma triggered at the time of death. And relatively speaking, they're there's some kind of pleasant feeling. So the gods, which is said to be a real existence of subtle minds with subtle physical energy. When we understand the Vajrayana model that describes the four elements and how we discussed and when we went through the death process, it's a bit similar to the Chinese concept and the Japanese, this, you know, understanding, you know, the use of that healing systems they have. It's a very similar idea. Same as the Ayurvedic system. It's another way of presenting physical reality, the four elements. And as we discuss in the Vajrayana, they describe all billions of consciousnesses pervading the universe, all of them conjoined just naturally with their own set of the four elements. So due to virtuous karma being programmed into the mind of one sentient being, and when they die, they wake up in this blissful, radiant state of mind, a real state called a god realm. And their physical energy isn't bags of bones like us. Light, subtle light. Their four elements have manifested due to virtue as light. Because whatever the mind does impacts upon the elements, you know. We described that during the week. Then you've got the suffering realms. And these are all expressions of the three poisons. They're an animal realm, predominantly of ignorance. The spirits, you can't see them. Their bodies are like made of air. Intense grasping energy, a billion times more powerful than any human grasping. And then the so-called hell realms, where the minds, you could argue, are conjoined with fire energy. And these are all, the Buddha would say, no one made these up. These are not made by anybody. They're all states of being created by those very sentient beings themselves. We are our own creators, Buddha says. No one sent us anywhere. That's a ridiculous idea for the Buddha. It's a natural law. This is what Buddha's saying. So one way of describing these three levels of suffering is in terms of these realms. So the lower realms are the suffering of suffering when the bad things happen. Then the upper realms are the suffering of change, the next one, which is what we call happiness. Then the third lot is called all-pervasive suffering, which is still another lot of sentient beings, which is really coming from the Hindu tradition, of these beings who've got the deepest of absorption in subtle concentration. There's certain stages of these, and these are called the form realm and the formless realm. They're all the components of all the beings in samsara, all of whom haven't realized emptiness. That's what defines us as being caught in samsara, you know. So the peak of these beings don't have the suffering of suffering and don't have the suffering of change, but they still have the subtle suffering of being in samsara because they haven't realized emptiness. The next lot, the suffering of happiness, I mean, you could say the gods don't have the suffering of suffering. Eventually they will. But they're predominantly the suffering of change. Or they will have it. They do have it. And then the suffering of suffering is just the worst one. This is a way of describing in terms of the whole realms of existence. But let's just look at it in terms of this life. That's also valid. And we get this one. So suffering of suffering is really obvious. It's when the bad things happen. And which, in other words, when things happen that trigger unpleasant feelings, that's what literally we mean by suffering, isn't it? And every being in the universe knows they don't want it. You don't need to be taught to not put your finger in the fire, you know. We don't like unpleasant experiences. That's the suffering of suffering. Now, the suffering of change, it sounds kind of boring, suffering of change, is what we refer to as happiness, literally. Let's do that analysis. It's so important. So what we mean in ordinary life, what we mean by suffering is when the bad things happen, and what we mean by happiness is when the good things happen. So the good things that happen, the Buddha is saying, is a subtler, more nuanced level of suffering because they change. That's not very convincing initially. We know the pleasure that does arise when we eat cake, and Buddha's not disagreeing. It is pleasure. Remember the third category, feeling. It is pleasure. But he's telling us it doesn't last. But we sort of go, well, yeah, we know that. But so what? Because why do we say that? Because we don't know any pleasure that does last. This is kind of interesting, isn't it? We all know somehow it doesn't last. But what's fascinating, when we go to the second noble truth, which is the causes, and as far as Buddha is concerned, there are two main causes, trillions of causes. There are many things that have to come together to produce a microphone, many things that come together to produce a flower, many things that come together to produce a moment of suffering. But he narrows it down to two, such that if we work on those, we can stop suffering. And they're both inside us. Karma, delusion. Okay, this word in Italian is not good, but it's perfect in English. These neurotic, disturbing emotions, these neurotic, disturbing misconceptions. These are the source of pain, Buddha says. So here, of those, like I said, Buddha has articulated 84,000 distinct problems. And then he presents the antidotes, 84,000, how to fix them. And it's a really elaborate map of all the problems. And he narrows them down. They all subsume into three. It's like a map of the mind. It's very fascinating. Ego grasping, the colloquial term we use for ignorance, the root neurosis, the root misconception. The one that's uprooted when we've realized emptiness. Second, the main voice, as we've discussed all week, the main voice of that ego grasping, this frantic, dissatisfied, emotionally hungry, manipulative, controlling, panic-stricken, fear-based, little needy me. Attachment. Simple word. It's huge. This runs the show. Effectively, in the Four Noble Truths, Buddha says this is the main source of pain in daily life, you know. Attachment. It's this emotional hunger and it's frantic to get pleasant feelings. And when it doesn't get what it wants, that attachment, or when it gets what it doesn't want, that turns into the third one, anger. So a better word for anger, because anger is, we mightn't all think we have it, but everyone's got it. But we tend to think of anger as the more volatile, shouting and yelling. But if we look at it in the terms of just the bare-bone states of mind, attachment is this emotional hunger, all excitedly kind of wanting the pleasant thing. And then the moment it hits the wall and gets the unpleasant thing, the panic attack called aversion arises. Aversion. This is so subtle. For people who don't get angry, who are really soft, gentle people, for you it manifests as fear, panic, stress, anxiety, despair, and depression. That's your response to when your attachment doesn't get what it wants. My response to when my attachment doesn't get what it wants is fly off the handle, shout and yell. And that's what we tend to think of as anger, isn't it? It's very volatile and obvious. But because we're not noticing our mind, that's why most of us in our culture, why depression is so prevalent, because we don't notice until it's too late. But this, technically, this aversion is happening 1,000 times a day, and it's the automatic response when the hungry little neediness in us doesn't get what it wants. And this is at ever subtle level. We're not talking about the gross level even. This is happening all the time. And because we don't notice, we don't deal with it. So it builds up until one day you can't get out of bed. One day you want to kill yourself and you don't know why. So, attachment. Of those three, attachment is the one that runs the show. Attachment is the one that's the source of the pain, Buddha says. So, where were we? What was I saying? I keep running, getting the wrong page. My finger goes on the thing. 40 something. What was I talking about? Where were we? 12 links. Four truths. Oh yeah, four noble truths. Okay. So in the second noble truth there are causes. Two. One past action that sows a seed in the mind and then the delusion, the neurosis that triggered it. Two main causes. Of course, again, a shock for us. Why are you suffering, Rabina? Well, Ron punched me. No one's got to argue with you. Buddha says, sorry, Rabina. He is a cause. He's only a secondary cause. I'm sorry. He's only a catalyst. Even, I tell you, we've been Buddhists for 50 years. Still, this is hard to really get hold of. We still don't believe it. I'm still convinced Ron's wrong, you know. I'm so obsessed because we're obsessed with the outside objects. So it's unbelievably sophisticated and hard to hear Buddha's words. Sorry, Rabina, they're not the main cause of your suffering at all. It's your mind, baby. And this is where the transforming problem teachers are so powerful. We know we can change our attitude about a thing that's horrible and we can call it good. So that proves the bad thing out there is not the main cause of your suffering. And this is proving emptiness. We know we can do it every day, but we don't join the dots. So what I'm getting at, the second kind of suffering is when attachment gets what it wants. So we look at the causes of suffering, then we understand attachment. That it's this hungriness, this emotional hunger, this craving, this yearning, this neediness. And why do you crave something and need something? Because you feel like you haven't got it. That's the main feeling of attachment, is a feeling of not being enough, not having enough, primordially dissatisfied. So, of course, we're always hungry. That's the next extension of attachment. And then attachment lies to us by exaggerating the deliciousness of the object because of karmic imprints. Look at the fisherman. He was an intelligent man. He was kind. He didn't put hooks in the mouth of his mother and let her agonizingly die a death on the ground. No. He's kind. But he had this imprint to kill. So this is a tragedy of attachment. His mummy said she never liked going fishing with him. She didn't want to criticize him. She didn't like it because she didn't like to kill fish. So she went one time and it was unbearable because he, you see, this is the point about attachment. He wasn't violent. He wasn't horrible. He wasn't trying to harm fish. But because of the habit of doing this, the attachment to it, he caught all those fish. He was a fisherman until he was 29 and when he finally died. And he saw fish in the boat every day. And of course, as we know, fish die slowly. You don't whack them on the head because you'll ruin your dinner. So you let it die agonizing death by breathing in what it doesn't want. It wants water, but we give it air. The poor thing dies an agonizing death. And all it can do is what? It doesn't have a voice. It can't shout. It can't squeal like a pig. It's got eyes that just stay open anyway. It's got no hands, no legs. I mean, what nightmare for the poor fish. But he was an intelligent, kind person. But he saw those fish, hundreds of thousands of them, from the time he was 5 through he was 29. And he never once saw suffering. This is the nightmare of attachment. It's a honey-covered razor blade when it causes us to harm others. It looks benign, and that's attachment. Because if the feeling is good that he got from habit, then the attachment writes the story, creates a delicious picture that blinds him from seeing the pain of the fish. But mummy, she didn't have the imprint to kill. She could see the fish suffering nakedly. That's the suffering of attachment. But it causes us to not see the suffering we're causing, you know, to other people. So attachment is the cause of the second kind of suffering. So the main suffering of pain, which we all know, is when attachment doesn't get what it wants. And the suffering of change is when attachment does get what it wants. So why is it suffering? Because, first of all, simply, it changes into the suffering of pain. We know intellectually the pleasure that comes from that cake won't last. We know it from our past experience. But because attachment is so hungry, it's a vampire. And even though we know intellectually it won't last, attachment is frantically kind of hoping, maybe this cake will do it this time and it'll give me happiness. Phew. We say when we're in love and found Ron and got the house and the baby and the house and the rest of the life, you say, now, finally, I found happiness. And what are we doing there? There's attachment. And then we set it in stone by calling it permanent. This is the killer because we can't bear the thought this happiness won't last forever. Even though we know it won't, we can't bear the thought that it won't. Because attachment grasps onto it. So we put this other lie on top and call it permanent. This is the one that is so destructive, so shocking. So then when we eat the cake, part of us is frantically kind of hoping this will do it. Because it does. The thing is, it does trigger pleasure. Remember, good feeling. It does do that. The cake meets the tongue. Pleasure is triggered. And because you're hungry, it's even more pleasure. We know that. And so it's so exciting, that first moment of pleasure. It is called pleasure. Fact. Nothing wrong with pleasure. But what happens? Why aren't we satisfied? Because it's actually the best pleasure. The second piece is already not as nice. We know it, but we're kind of hoping every time. Maybe the next one will make me get pleasure again. And we're never satisfied. So we're never satisfied. Until what? Gradually, incrementally, you know, naturally, as you keep eating the cake, hoping more pleasure will come, but knowing, because you know from yesterday, but you can't bear to think about it, that it's actually inexorably turning into the suffering of suffering. Now you want to vomit. So now how does the cake look? What's happened in your mind? Attachment has turned into aversion. The feelings have turned from pleasure into pain. And if you ate another piece, you would vomit. We know this, but we can't bear the truth of it. It's too painful because we don't know what to do instead. We have no other method. This is scientific fact. This is not religion. So think of any object of any of your senses, any experience, any event, anything you've ever done that triggers pleasure, that as you keep doing it, increases the pleasure. You will not find it. And I always use extreme examples. I don't want to embarrass you, but I can't help it. My mind goes a bit crazy. I always think of the best pleasure in the universe. Most of us think it's having a nice boyfriend, isn't it? Tactile consciousness. Delicious pleasure is definitely triggered. Well, I'm sorry to be gross, but can you imagine, I don't want to get too much detail, but it's obvious. Keep doing that action. 1, 2, 3, 4, 20, 30, 40 times. You know pleasure will not increase, it'll decrease, and you will want to vomit and die. And you'll never want to touch Ron again. Hear my point. Am I not true? Is this not scientific truth? Is it scientific truth? Buddha's just pointing out scientific truth. But we can't bear the thought of it. So Buddha's right. It turns into suffering. But next day, what do you remember when you see the cake? You forget that it caused you indigestion. You forget it made you full. You forget it added kilos. You forget the acid reflux. And you get excited and think it'll do it again. So you try again. Buddha says we've been doing this since the beginning of this time. Bit stupid. Bashing our heads against brick walls. I know we can. It's good to make it extreme because then we can hear it, you know. So then what we've got to think, what the hell is the way out of this? What are we going to do? Where's your solution, please? Come on, give me a solution. Well, the way that Buddhism presents it, you've got to wait. It takes time. So let's cut to the chase. What's Buddha's solution? Well, he has found that this attachment causes pain, like we just described. And it not only is the honey-covered razor blade, but it turns into the suffering of suffering. Because then when you get the suffering of suffering, maybe just getting full from cake was okay, but, you know, when you want to harm people, kill, lie, steal, that comes from attachment not getting what it wants. So it causes to harm others as well. So Buddha's saying, just keep the cake or the body as our simple examples of getting pleasure. He doesn't argue that that's not pleasure. He agrees it is pleasure. It's called a pleasant feeling. There's no argument with it. It's a pleasant feeling. And it's but like I said last week, this week, whenever I said it, because I've been here 10 years. The pleasant feeling is pleasant. We know that. But it's the only way we know how to get a pleasant feeling. Happiness, pleasant feelings. But what Buddha has found, as we're discussing, that attachment is this poison, neurotic, vampire, hungry, poor, unhappy, demented part of us, that its job just does its best to try and find an object, and then we have contact with the object, and then pleasure is triggered. But all Buddha's saying is it's really limited. It's a really limited method. And the tragedy of it is that it will trigger some pleasure, but because you keep hoping that having more cake will bring more pleasure, we all know it brings less pleasure, and then eventually it becomes the suffering of suffering. So that's a fact we can see. But the other thing that's most tragic about attachment is my mother used to say, the more you get, the more you want. Attachment thinks the more you get, the more satisfied you'll get. The exact opposite. That's the tragedy. In other words, we deepen our suffering. So he says, hey, guys, I've found a method of how to get pleasant feelings, and that's all happiness means. And we're talking relative reality here. So basically, he's found a method to stop suffering, to stop the causes of attachment. It's hard work. It's enormously hard work. So we can, you know, have all sorts of marvellous methods to get us to cut to the chase, to get us to get tastes of it. And it's true, they're all there, all these marvellous meditation techniques. But this is like the technology of it, the analysis of it, you know. So Buddha's saying that our mind, our consciousness, is naturally blissful and clear and wise and perfect. So there are many analogies for it, you know, like, you know, we were talking before, you can say that's already there, our Buddha. But the other way to say it is, you know, another way to say it, it is there, the potential is always there. And he has found the methods of how to remove the pollution, put it like that, you know, so that we can now taste the true nature of our being, which is bliss, joy, fulfilled, content, wise, compassionate, empathetic, clear. These are our natural state, Buddha has found. These are our natural state. And you won't get them from cake or bodies or money or any objects of the senses or through any attachment. It doesn't come. That's the opposite. It looks like it, but it's the opposite. So the pleasure that we have now is still pleasure, but the Buddha is saying it's contaminated and it's very short-lived. And I remember years ago when I was editing our magazine when I was living in California, 95, I was editing Mandala, and I interviewed one of our wonderful monks, the Swiss monk, Venerable Rene, who's a professional meditator, years and years, you know. And I interviewed him about his particular 2.5-year retreat at Urselling in Spain, up in the mountains near Granada. He was doing cultivating single point of concentration, shamatha, which is described in the text in terms of 9 stages of cultivation. And he said he maybe in that 2.5 years touched upon the 5th of the 9 stages, you know. And he said, and this is the point, as we talked in Lama's book, in Mahamudra, you know. Lama likes to get us all excited, so he talked about some of the qualities that we would accomplish having concentration. And he described the mind as absolutely radiant, clear, crystal clear, and totally, naturally peaceful and blissful. Buddha's saying this is, even before we realize emptiness, don't worry about that. Well before we become a Buddha, our mind has this capacity. It is in its nature that. So to posit this, we have to posit the possibility that we're not talking about the brain, because as we know in psychology, this is not how we describe the brain, as innately pure, you know. So we're discussing our cognitive process itself, our consciousness, and that's what Buddha's found. So even temporarily in meditation, even temporarily having subdued to some degree the grosser conceptual and sensory level of cognition, and this is what Rene said, just touched upon the 5th of the 9 stages of single-pointed concentration. He says, it was very humble, you know, he talked about it, and it's very powerful, I think, to hear examples of people who in our culture, because we all assume it's all these Asians that get enlightened, you know. Yes. Only, but us, you know, white people, we're thick and stupid. Ridiculous. He said that no question that the peace, and hear the word literally peace, you know, peaceful and bliss, joy, that he experienced this in his mind naturally, infinitely peaceful, content, and blissful, was so superior to any bliss he'd ever experienced through his senses. And all that's doing is trying to get the point that Buddha's making. And this is our nature, it's our potential, it's who we are. But the more attachment, the more anger, the more fears, the more jealousy, the more depression, less pleasure. That's it. And, of course, we're junkies for the other stuff, so it's hard to... It's good to hear it. It gives us courage. And it's not just a hit and miss. And it's not like a blessing. It's not a gift from God. You know? It's your mind that does it. We're the boss. So, basically, we think happy feelings are what we get when we get what attachment wants. Buddha says, no, no, no. Happy feelings, bliss, pleasure, joy, you name it, are what you get when you give up attachment. Just a hard job, that's all. To cut through the old habits. 10:45. Any questions now before we have a break? About that so far. Any questions? So we're in the Heart Sutra and we're up to describing the Four Noble Truths and we're looking at suffering and the cause of suffering. So, and we're discussing this first and the second kind. We haven't got to the third one yet. So any questions? Yes, sweetheart. I want to stick to this topic. Do you mind, darling? What we're on to this morning. Is that okay? We'll discuss it later, maybe. See how. If there's no other questions, I'm happy to, yeah. And think about what we've discussed now today, attachment, suffering, happiness, these different points. No, okay. Okay. Yes, go, sweetheart. Go, Kira. Yes.
It's about the fisherman, the young man. Mm-hmm. So his mom didn't want to kill the fish, but maybe his mom cooked the fish and ate the fish, the same thing that I do.
So what's the question?
So the question is that, is there a responsibility in not directly killing but eating?
So what do you mean by responsibility?
Meaning that you are, in a way, accepting that there is an act of violence towards another living being.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't...
Is that her motive? Like we talk... Okay. Okay. We can see everything is so subtle. In the end, keep the microphone, please. Keep it. We can see that everything we do and say and think, because it all happens so quickly, it can be so subtle and so nuanced. There's so many conditions, so many scenarios, so many variations. But we can all start with the simplest principles, can't we? Right? You agree with that? Okay. So, as we discussed during the week, when we analyze, we break down an action, karma, and we're doing one of these every millisecond, driven by intention. It's so quick and so subtle. So if we break down an action, and if we look into one action called killing, for example, and we look into what are the components that cause an action of killing to be called an action of killing, which means it's called a negative action, which means it sows a seed in your mind, which means it'll ripen its future suffering. What defines that action? Well, there are four components, as we discussed. The first is the object. For an action to be killing, technically for me to create an action of killing a sentient being, there has to be an object there called a living being, a living fish. Second, there has to be in my mind an intention to kill it. And then the next part of the mind is the motivation for why. And usually, as we know from fishermen, they don't hate fish. It's attachment. Right? Habit. Do you understand? So motivation is attachment. Three, you do the action and kill the fish. And four, the fish is dead. Now, I'll bring the fish home to you. I did that, right? That's me. I did that. And I'll bring the fish home to you. And you don't like killing fish. But you want to make your boy happy. Want to feed him and give him a dinner, you know, or whatever. So you decide you're going to cook the fish. So your action is called what? What's your action called first? What's it called? What action are you doing? What's the name of the action you're doing, Kira? Thank you very much. It's called cooking. And what's the object of cooking? You don't have a pan with a fire, nothing in the pan, do you? You've got to have a thing to cook, don't you? Well, it might be a vegetable, it might be a bit of flesh, mightn't it? It might be that, mightn't it? Now, intellectually, you know it did have a mind once. You knew it was a sentient being, didn't you? Now, that's all. So in your mind involved in it, the second point, it depends on what's in your mind. So if you're thinking, oh, I'm so happy Rabina killed the fish and it saves me the bother, what a relief, then this is like worse than killing. You're rejoicing in my killing. But let's say you're a nice mummy and you don't like harming fish. Like my auntie, Rabina Bliss, who married Stasis Arkoshauskas, who was a Lithuanian peasant, who was a Nazi. He came into Australia after the war. I mean, he was a nice Nazi, but he was a Nazi, basically. And he was a nice peasant, but he killed fish. He killed, like I told you, he killed the quails in the quail season, the chickens in the chicken season, the fish in the fish season, the eels, and I'd never eaten eels before, the eels in the eel season. That's just what he did. My auntie, my poor darling auntie, we called her Nin, she was called Rabina. She hated killing animals. But she was a good wife and tried. She was almost in tears skinning the rabbits and she couldn't bear it. Don't tell me she created negative karma. Give me a break. It depends on what's in your mind, baby. The damn thing's dead. It's not a philosophical position. It's a real genuine thing you do with your mind and your body based on your motivation. So it's more nuanced than just, oh, you're as bad as the fisherman. The fundamentalist vegans and vegetarians say that. Like, we mean the word fundamentalist, meaning the political activists who shout and yell at everybody. You've got to be careful. I mean, you might want to analyze it carefully. What's in the mind? One time I remember one of our lamas with his Western translated disciple went to dinner. And the woman offered meat. And the translator said, I don't eat meat. And the lama said, you eat that meal. I mean, there's more things to it than eating. We're so obsessed with eating, I think, in our culture. That's why I told you when I put a story on my Facebook page, someone does it for me, I don't look at it, and she put a picture of me in the shop in Liverpool in England going to this amazing cheese shop, and I bought some kick-ass cheddar, okay? And I said, this picture, then all these fundamentalists, how dare a Buddhist nun eat cheese, this kind of thing. Well, I didn't want to be political, you know? So I'd always wondered how many bugs get destroyed. I told you this, bugs get killed on the road when you drive cars. Well, sure enough, Google it and some Dutch bloke had done the research. And it's sort of per number plate in America, per kilometre, per car. It's like trillions, you know. So excuse me, because we don't eat the bugs, we don't care if they die. And the even more telling was the story, the Australian journalist got fed up with all the fundamentalist vegans criticising, you know. He talked about this wheat field. Well, they grow wheat, 20% for the bulls, probably, for the meat eaters, and then 80% for the vegans and vegetarians. And when there's no wheat growing, there are millions and millions of field mice. And he said they were so cute. They sang love songs to each other. He had photos of them. And then, of course, when you have to plant the wheat, what do? You slaughter the lot. For whom? The vegans. But this fellow, when I put that story on, the vegan said, oh, that you just can't help that. That is insanity. How could, just because we don't eat them, we think it doesn't matter. I mean, that's emotional and extreme, you know. The Buddha says just by existing on this planet, we are destroying, just by existing and breathing, we are destroying sentient beings. So we've got to get a bigger picture here. Yeah, of course, the meat industry destroys the planet. It's monstrous. That's not the issue. It's more than just that, you know. And it's really nuanced. It's very hard to see. Because you have to see a person's mind. So you can generalize, killing is this and wrong, therefore this, therefore that. But then each person's different scenario, different time, different place. And the key one, of course, is watch our own minds like a hawk and watch our own body and speech and mind our own business. Yeah, be political. Go out there and try and change the meat industry. Fantastic, you know. That was a bigger answer to your question, but it's important information, I think. Do you understand? And I think it's because we're attached to food, you know. If you don't eat it, it doesn't matter. I remember this guy, he was a vegan. He said, no, you can't help that, he said. It was very bizarre, I thought, that. These rats with millions of little mice slaughtered. They probably weren't slaughtered nicely. You understand? I mean, how can you say it doesn't matter? It's interesting to think about. So it's what's in the mind, very important. So if you are sitting there happy that I killed it instead of you, that's heavy. It's what's in your mind. Do you understand? Does that make sense, Kira? What else before tea break? Yes, go, Max.
About eating plant life.
Eating who?
A plant life.
A plant, yes.
And vegetables.
Yeah.
My auditor in India was a Jain.
Yes, that's right.
And he doesn't eat garlic and he doesn't eat onions. And
I understand that, yes, I understand that.
And
so then?
His explanation was his explanation why he eats other plants and not garlic and onions.
Oh, well, yeah.
It's because they're roots from which life originates.
Oh, are they? I don't know about them.
And I was just wondering, because I know the stance in Buddhism is that plants aren't sentient beings.
It's not a stance, it's an observation of a holy being. That a sentient being. Okay, the universe is made of matter, right? The four elements. So plants are four elements. That's four elements. And this is four elements. Well, the way the Buddhists would put it would be this, the difference between this or a plant and this four elements is this one's imbued with a consciousness. That's all. Okay, we can't see that initially because we're not clairvoyant. But as you progress spiritually, you'll be able to know if that's true. So I can just only state what the Buddha says. Do you understand? That's for us to find out, you know. So tell us, ask us your death question now, sweetheart.
Parlavamo ieri appunto del morire in una condizione favorevole, cioè con persone intorno tranquille per recitare un mantra e non perdere niente. So I guess we're talking about to die in a kind of pleasant environment with the people around that repeat the mantra and then the person can be kind of tranquil when dies.
That's right.
Ed è un segno positivo per la vita futura.
That's right. That's what they say.
Se l'esperienza del bardo è traumatica o molto forte, può produrre un cambio del seme?
If the experience in the bardo is very frantic and terrific and so forth, can change this karma?
The person themselves.
The person themselves.
Okay. In general, wouldn't you say for all of us that if we're in a dream, having a dream, most of us don't even know we're dreaming, so we have no control. Would you agree with that? Would you agree with that? Yeah? Would you agree with that? You agree with that? Well, then why do you think you can have control if you're in the bardo, which is an even more intense experience? If you're a holy being, if you're a practitioner, of course you have control. You have control through the death process because you've meditated all your life. You have control when you die. You have control everywhere. You're in control of it. You're in control, including every level of your being. That's what the great yogis can do. So it's up to what your practice is. But other Lama Zopa, because he's into all these practices and mantras and Lord knows what, he says there are many practices that we can do for the dying person to help change their karma, even in the bardo, yes. You understand? Why don't we have a cup of tea break or a coffee break or a scone and cream break or something. Okay. See you in half an hour.